Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we mark 5 years on the air. So we've gone back and pulled what we think are some of the best stories we've featured. You'll find out if Philo really is the center of the universe, learn the history of Paint by Numbers, meet the man who helped restore the Virginia Theater's Wurlitzer organ, and much more. All tonight on this special edition of Sidetrack. One of the early features we did here on Sidetrack was about a group of people who gathered on Friday and Saturday nights to play out complex stories involving vampires and ghosts. They were members of a live-action role-playing group that combined elements of folklore, theater, and gaming to create a unique form of entertainment. Most of us at one time have read a story about ghosts or vampires or watched a classic horror film and imagined ourselves in the haunted and tragic world of those characters. Well, there are a group of people who get together on the weekends and do just that. They call themselves LARPers, which stands for Live Action Role Players. They have groups all around the country who play out these complex games where people create characters who act out storylines created by storytellers. The main storyteller for tonight's game is Tom DeLuca.
Frankly, you don't want to tell somebody who has no idea what you're doing, oh yeah, we're walking around, we're playing vampires. We're pretending to be vampires for the night, everything's fine. That would scare somebody. So what we'll say is, we describe it as interactive theater. In a way it is, because a lot of actual acting takes place. So that's the best way to describe it to someone who doesn't know what's going on. It's like interactive theater, but it has elements of a game.
The players often dress and act like the characters they've created, characters as original and varied as the people who play them.
He's a member of a secret organization, the Children of Osiris, who... they actively attempt to maintain their humanity and try to help others do so as well.
I'm playing a gypsy Kaitif, which is clanless right now, whose clan was destroyed, and she's currently hunting for the person who did it.
His name is Alec de Coudroy, and he's a French / Egyptian follower of Set, which is a clan of debased evil corruptors.
It's easy to make the comparison between Vampire and the classic game Dungeons & Dragons, but because of its theatrical nature, Vampire players use a more creative system.
These sit-down tabletop role-playing games were mostly paper and dice. Since dice are unwieldy when you're actually physically walking around portraying your characters, the Mind's Eye Theater system by White Wolf focuses on rock, paper, scissors. So when people get into a challenge where, say, one person is declaring that they're stronger than the other person, they both engage in a series of rock, paper, scissors. The ultimate winner wins the challenge. Players themselves, their characters will create their own plots. You'll find a lot of conspiracy, people vying for power, people manipulating others. It's technically a game of political intrigue and manipulation, but there's a lot of fighting that goes on in the game.
Attentive. Very good. All right. All of you do not take any damage from the fact that opening up beneath your feet is a kneel.
Besides Vampire, there's another game going on here tonight. This one is called Wraith, and it deals with ghosts and the spirit world. The main storyteller for this game is Jason Brandon.
It's a game based upon tragedy. You're playing a shadow of your former self. You're a ghost. You are not a physical body. You are regret and angst and passion personified, but you're not a body anymore. The game is used as a tool to explore all of human existence, and Wraith makes us look at certain things like emotions and what motivates us and what is important to us. These are the things that comes out in Wraith. In Vampire, things that come out are politics and violence. These are not the main things that come out in, say, Wraith. The game is a great delve into each other's psyche and a shared imagination where we can find what motivates us and what is important to us.
No matter which game they're in, each player has their own reasons for playing the characters they play. Player and storyteller Adam Ruggieri likes the theatrical aspect.
The whole concept of impromptu acting really appeals to me. Also, I've got a very stressed home life, so this gives me a chance to break free and be someone other than myself, and nifty powers to boot.
Bill Bullock, on the other hand, likes playing a villain, someone the total opposite of who he is in real life.
I get the chance to be Darth Vader. It's something really different. I get the chance to be the devil's advocate. Kind of literally. It brings up real moral issues. I get to take a stand that I totally disagree with and watch the drama that comes out of that.
Another player, Terry King, likes the game because it lets her explore the motivations and emotions of the characters.
It's a chance to act when I never really could act before. It's a chance to be someone else and try to think like a different person for a few hours, to try to react not only logically but emotionally. And it's a real challenge. It's a lot of fun.
In the current debate of violence in entertainment, a game like Vampire seems caught in the middle. DeLuca explains that the violence, which is wholly imagined in this game, is a necessary aspect.
Because the whole idea of playing a vampire is you are a monster. You do live. You cannot walk out in the sun. You exist at night. You prey on the lifeblood of helpless humans. But meanwhile, you are struggling to retain what humanity you had. I think that doesn't glorify violence at all. It's the story of succumbing to that violence, succumbing to the violent tendencies, watching all the violence happen around you and reacting accordingly, either by running away, by crying, or by actually participating.
But as Brandon points out, most LARPers know how to draw that line between the game and reality, but sometimes that line does get blurred.
I think one of the big things with any live-action game, there's always the threat of people, one thing, taking the game too far. It is just a game. It is just a make-believe game. It's like playing cops and robbers when you're a kid, but we've got rules to help quantify things a little better. One of the dangers is people taking things personally, people forgetting that it's just a game. Where that gets difficult is players try to do more than their character should be able to do. And then other players feel offended by this because they're not playing by the rules. They're in effect cheating. The term for that is metagaming. Or mega gaming.
Storytellers are keenly aware of the negativity a mega gamer can bring and are always quick in acting to keep things from going too far. Overall, LARPers strive to create a safe environment where people can explore their own creativity. Ruggieri sums it up like this.
There are a lot of different things that give off the wrong kind of vibe, vampires being one of them. And a lot of parents would actually, I get calls from parents about their kids, you know, what is my kid doing? He walked out of the house dressed in black, carrying a white piece of paper with some weird guy's name on it, and he says he's going to go play vampire, and I have to answer that. The typical answer I give them is, well, would you rather they were here in a nice, safe environment, which is watched over by mature people, where no drugs, no violence, no negative aspects at all, other than the theme, are allowed, or would you rather they were out on the streets doing those things? I think we're actually a good element in today's society. It gives people the chance to do something that's fun, attractive, but not necessarily bad. The darker aspect is what's cool about it, but also it's something to do with your Friday and Saturday evenings that does not involve all the negative things that they talk about.
For Sidetrack, I'm Jason Croft. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Sidetrack. Man has long contemplated his place in the universe, but could the answer be closer than we think? Back in June of 2000, Tom Rogers went looking to see if maybe, just maybe, the center of the universe could be found in Champaign County.
Did the universe have to begin somewhere? Does it have a middle, an origin, a center? It might. Say, just above the railroad crossing, about 200 feet up, on the eastern edge of the central business district of Philo, Illinois. Look at their water tower, it'll tell you. So will Philo's former mayor, Gene McCormick.
Like if I go somewhere and they say, where are you from? And I'll say, oh, from Philo. And they'll say, oh, center of the universe. But it's just one of those things that, by the radio, power of the radio.
It was a radio personality who coined the term center of the universe for our centerpiece village of 1300, WDWS in Champaign, morning man Stevie J, a native Philan or Philoite or Philonian. According to the town's written history of the term, the family was living in India, and a brother of Stevie J's noted that the town of Batur called itself the center of the universe. Well, he theorized that you could drill a straight line through the center of the earth, straight down from Batur, and wind up in Philo. So the center applies there, too. A few mentions on the morning show led to the slogan on the tower, and it's been there since 1987. Well, being an employee of a famous research university, where theories are tested every day, I decided to scientifically question what people in Philo take as fact.
Everywhere in the universe, there is a microwave radiation at about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero.
That's Larry Smarr. He's the outgoing head of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. His main discipline is astrophysics.
Now, why do you care? Because what that tells us is that that was the last signature of what we call the Big Bang, which created the universe. Now, a lot of people figure that that means that there was a center of the explosion, right? And that would be the center of the universe.
Now that we've established that there could be a center of the universe, we have to determine whether it is, in fact, catty corner from the Philo Tavern or not.
Well, the thing I love about cosmology is that what we really know is that if you want to be the center of the universe, then you can be. Everybody can be the center of the universe because Everhwais is more or less like every other place if you look at it on the large enough scale. There's no preferred center, so Philo might as well be the center of the universe.
So to say the very least, Philo is definitely in the running, along with anything and everything else in the universe, another galaxy or continent or town or street, water tower, bird, speck of dust, atom, heck, even Sydney.
Yeah, that would work. That would work. I think that's a great...
Does that take away from Philo's cachet, though? I mean, no. If everybody can be the center of the universe?
Not really. Not really. I think it'll make most of them happy to know that it's really true. It's not a joke.
But then what if Sydney comes out and says, we're the center of the universe?
They could, I suppose, but I don't think they would...
It
might fly, but I don't think they would do that. I think because, you know, we're in proximity to them, and we have friends there, they have friends here. They wouldn't take that away from us.
They could say we're like 6 miles from the center.
Yeah. Yeah, they could do that. That's right.
Here's an unsettling point, though. The longer you stand on that corner there in Philo, everything around you, the curb, the water tower, the train, the bar, the bank, the houses, any matter anywhere in the entire universe, is slowly moving away from you, and in turn, from everything else.
Say you went out and looked at, from Philo, you set up a telescope, and you went and looked at a bunch of distant galaxies. What you'd find is, in every direction in the sky you look, they're all running away from Philo, as if you were the center of the universe. Now, it turns out that if you went out to San Francisco, or you went to Mars, or you went to the next galaxy over, the Andromeda Galaxy, and you looked out, you'd see exactly the same thing. Every place looks as if it's the center of the universe. Only a few of them call themselves the center of the universe. Think of it this way. Take a balloon and put little dots of paint equally distant from each other all over the balloon so it's freckled. Okay? And so there's the same distance between all those objects. Now, blow up the balloon. slowly. And what happens, of course, as the balloon gets bigger and bigger, the distance between all those spots gets greater and greater and greater, right? Now, sit on one of those spots of paint and look at all the ones everywhere around the balloon. They're all moving away from you. You think you're the center of the universe. But now, go to any other dot of paint, and if you look at it, everything's moving away from you because the space is uniformly expanding under you. It'll be so hard to measure that, you know, it might be a trillionth of an inch, you know, in 100 million years or something. But fundamentally, that's what's going on.
So, enjoy small towns while you can. People in Philo certainly are.
It's just a nice little town with comfortable people and comfortable places to live. And we're just comfortable with each other. A lot of new people have come into town, and I'm sure they probably all think we're nuts.
But not nuts enough to pass up a marketing opportunity. You can buy the Center of the Universe t-shirt, the cap, even the Center of the Universe coverlet at the Philo 125th anniversary celebration later this summer. Clever strategy, and such is the way of the universe.
The universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. In November 2002, Jim Meadows featured a group of hockey fans at the University of Illinois that could have been called anti-cheerleaders. They went to Illini hockey games not to cheer their home team, but to mock the opponents. They called themselves the Harassing Illini.
It's Friday night at the U of I Ice Arena, and the Illini Varsity's men's hockey team has just scored a goal against the visiting Indiana Hoosiers. The crowd goes wild, but the cheers and applause aren't enough for a group of fans in Section CC above the home team bench. Turning to the hapless Indiana players who have just allowed an Illini goal, they begin the chant that will be heard several times during tonight's game. It's all your fault, just one of the catchphrases of the Harassing Illini, a group of University of Illinois students who attend Friday night hockey games at the Ice Arena to, as their website puts it, offend and deject the opposing team.
We really have to give a lot of credit to the older guys and women of U of I that established a tradition many years ago of sitting over the opposing team bench and really reaming out the opposition. And, well, when we came here freshman year and saw our first game, that was really what turned us on to it. And so pretty much we just wanted to make that official and kind of ensure that that would be around for future generations of hockey fans.
That's Nick Bridge, an engineering major and vice president of the Harassing Illini. He helped found the club, and it is an official campus student organization, with Dennis Timpanaro, a business major, and the group's president. The big sports at Illinois are football and basketball, and they're played in big places, holding tens of thousands of spectators. Hockey is a club sport at the University of Illinois, played in a smaller venue. But Timpanaro says the more intimate confines of the ice arena are a plus for the harassing Illini.
You go to a football game or a baseball game, and, you know, everyone goes with their school spirit on, but, you know, they don't actually feel like they're participating in the game. Here at the hockey rink, essentially you're talking to the players. All your friends are like 5 feet from you, and it just, it's a great atmosphere that encourages that kind of entertainment.
Hey, you suck!
Sitting in the front row of Section CC with the harassing Illini, the game going on just a few feet below me, it seemed that the players must hear every taunt, to the point that they might become used to it. But if group chants lose their impact, the harassing Illini are ready to get personal. During the game, Nick Bridge holds a small but very dangerous piece of paper.
This is every player on the Indiana University roster, all their parents' names, their favorite musicians, their favorite movies, their silly hobbies like playing the air guitar. Fun things.
Gathering this information requires a separate officer's position at the harassing Illini, Director of Research. The job is held by Dino Tataris.
This was actually all on the Indiana University website, so I didn't really have to look anywhere. They gave it all to us.
Love it.
At this game, Bridge and Timpanaro carried the weight of the personal remarks. They called out the names of the parents of Indiana goalie Charlie Pulley.
Steve and Nancy!
They picked on one of defenseman Mike Piotrowski's favorite Hollywood stars.
Look out for Meg Ryan! Look out!
They celebrated the news that Indiana forward Adam Trussell was in the campus finance club.
Trussell's in the finance club!
And they saluted forward Matt Ritz for his disclosure that he enjoys playing golf.
Golf clap for Ritz!
Woo, Ritz! Woo, Ritz! Yay!
College golf tournaments do not attract the likes of the harassing Illini, but hockey does and even romanticizes them. The reason why is simple to Katie Berry, longtime hockey fan and first-time harassing Illini.
Because it's hockey. Hockey has the best fans in the world. It's the best game. It's great.
For Nick Bridges, it's not the simple watching of a hockey game that provides a getaway from college studies. It's the opportunity to be one of the fans, yelling his lungs out at the opposing team.
So this is more fun than if you were just quietly sitting watching the nuances of the sport?
Oh, it certainly is. In such a violent sport as hockey, one must be obnoxious along with it. It's only appropriate.
The harassing Illini did their work so thoroughly and in such close proximity to the Indiana players that I just didn't have the nerve to go up to them afterwards and ask what they thought about it. But the home team seems to welcome the harassing Illini. Illini team captain Brad Tilden, who scored 2 goals that night, says hockey is such an emotional game that the encouragement from the fans can fuel their own energy and enthusiasm. He says when fans of the other team abuse him verbally, the effect is mixed.
It can work both ways. I mean, it can either get you down when you're frustrated, or it can give you that much more motivation to really stick it to the other team by going out there and popping a few goals.
But Tilden says the harassing Illini are particularly good at what they do, outdoing the verbal abuse the Illinois team receives at away games, except maybe at Iowa State. While no one on the Indiana team seemed to respond to the insults coming their way that night, Illini forward Brian Coleman says that's not always the case.
They get to the other team, it happens. You know, people will, their team will go after, you know, do something to fans, throw a stick up there, scream, yell. Takes them off their game a little bit, so it helps us even if maybe we're not paying attention to it at the time because we're focusing on our own game.
The Indiana Hoosiers lost to Illinois 5-3 that Friday night, and the Illini beat them again 5-0 at the Saturday night rematch. The Illini Hockey Club has won every game so far this season, And at least for Friday night home games, the harassing Illini will be doing their bit to keep the team in the winner's column all the way to tournament time in February. I'm Jim Meadows.
Still to come on this special edition of Sidetrack, Warren York and the Virginia Theater's Wurlitzer Organ, and the man who created Paint by Numbers. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Back in the fall of 2002, hundreds of people from across the country came to the small southern Illinois town of Alney to celebrate the 100-year anniversary of an albino rodent. Allie Kawa was there.
It's hard to appreciate just how seriously the town takes its white squirrels.
We've advertised them, protected them, fed them, nursed them. You name it, we've tried to do it.
It's a symbol of Alney, I guess.
Not everybody has them. There's something very unique, and we enjoy seeing them and taking care of them.
That last testimonial is Belinda Hinton. She's the one who organized the anniversary festival, quite possibly the largest celebration of white squirrels to date. Alney's not the only town in the U.S. to boast of white squirrels. In fact, there are at least three others. But people who study these types of things, like the Squirrel Lovers Association, say the town of Alney promotes the squirrels far more than the other towns. They pray for the white squirrels.
That we give thanks to God for the uniqueness that white squirrels have added to the city of Alney, we pray, Lord, hear our prayer.
The police have a white squirrel profile on the arm of their uniforms. They even have a town song about them. After all this hype and hours spent in the town, I had yet to even see one of the albino creatures. So I enlisted the help of Squirrel Lovers President Greg Bassett.
There's one on the ground, right over there.
Oh my gosh.
There you go.
Do you want to try to feed him?
You want to try?
Sure.
Take a peon with you.
Okay.
Just hold your fingers. Just
how close should I get?
He might take
Let's squat down and call him over to me.
Hey,
you.
He's not interested.
Just go slowly so you'll move fast.
Yay, he did it. I can't believe he's not scared.
Pretty, aren't they? Come here.
The squirrels are remarkably clean. They're pure white with a tail like spun sugar and little pink eyes. No one knows exactly how they got to Alney. Legend has it they were either left by a traveling circus or set free by a resident who had a couple on display at a local tavern. And experts are baffled as to why the squirrels stay. Various universities, biologists, and state agencies have studied the rodents at Alney and the other towns the white squirrels inhabit, but they can't explain why they're not found more than 2 miles outside town limits. Whatever the reason, they're big business in the small town of Alney.
White squirrels are to Alney what the Eiffel Tower is to Paris. And I know they're very protective of their white squirrels, and they should be for that reason. It is very important to them.
And residents will continue to celebrate them, selling squirrel feeders, houses, buttons, T-shirts, and yard signs, just to name a few. But even lifelong resident and composer Mary Lou Jenkins admits it is possible to go a little overboard.
I wrote the song Willie on his little white squirrel, and I think it's a cute song because... Alneda is famous for their white squirrels, but they're not my whole life.
Oh,
I'm Allie Kawa.
Squirrels are a lot like human beings. There's bad ones, there's good ones, there's nervous ones, there's friendly ones, there's a couple you need to kill.
You're listening to Sidetrack. One of the things we love to do here on the program is bring in musicians for live performances and a little chit-chat. We've featured indie rock, rockabilly, folk, country, bluegrass, and jazz. Here now are a couple of live performances from the WILL studios. First, alternative country artist Robbie Foulkes with the song, She Took a Lot of Pills and Died.
Well, with her drop-dead looks and her little girl charm, everybody thought she'd go far. And at 20 years old, she was rich as could be and a world-famed Hollywood star. With the big parts coming and the sweethearts, too, life was a hell of a ride. But her star soon fell and her body got old, so she took a lot of pills and died. Well, she took a lot of pills and died. Took a lot of pills and died. Her star soon fell and her body got old, so she took a lot of pills and died. While the traffic crawled by in the street outside, she was sitting in her kitchenette, listening to the scuttle of the rats in the wall, staring at her TV set. Well, she once might have been too proud to be found in a hovel on the Lower East Side. But nothing in the world seemed to matter much now, so she took a lot of pills and died. Well, she took a lot of pills and died. Took a lot of pills and died. Nothing in the world seemed to matter to her, so she took a lot of pills and died. Now she hasn't been seen on the silver screen, and she never may be again. But every once in a while at the far end of the dial, you can see her like she was back then. In a soft close-up with her hair backlit, she seemed to glow inside. Yeah, but something went wrong, cause 40 years on, she took a lot of pills and died. Well, she took a lot of pills and died. Took a lot of pills and died. Something went wrong, cause 40 years on, she took a lot of pills and died. She took a lot of pills and died. Yeah, she took a lot of pills and died.
That was Robbie Foulkes with the tune, She Took a Lot of Pills and Died. Now, a band called June and the Exit Wounds with their song, Middle School.
What can I do to make you look my way?
the stupid guy. And I still wonder why I can't make you mine.
That was the band June and the Exit Wounds with the song Middle School, performed here live at the WILL Studios. This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. There's an element of the movie-going experience that has all but vanished across the United States. It's that of the theater organ. In the days of silent film, the organ was used to score the film, provide the sound effects, and entertain the crowd before the show. In the last decade, the music of the theater organ has returned to Champaign's Virginia Theater, thanks to a group of restorers led by one man. From June 2001, here's the story of Warren York and the theater organ he plays. Up until a few years ago, this type of music, that of the Wurlitzer theater organ, a staple of the golden age of theater palaces, was absent from the walls of the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. It, along with the rest of the theater, had gone into disrepair. Nowadays, thanks mostly to the efforts of one man, Warren York, this Wurlitzer has come back to life.
You're a conductor here at the thing. You've got control of all the instruments, and you tell which instrument to come in at what time and what to do with it.
And you can do a lot with this type of organ, which, to be specific, is the Virginia Theater's original 1921 Wurlitzer Hope Jones Unit Orchestra, commonly known as the Wurlitzer Theater Organ. When you look at it, it's a pretty amazing piece of technology.
I love machinery, and this is a real complex piece of machinery. what we see here has nothing to do with making the sound other than these are switches, just switches. Switches under these, the keys, switches under the stops, switches under the pedals. That's all it does. This is the key desk, the switches. It makes no sound. The sound is all made from there. From these switches here, we have 12 volts that goes from here to a little magnet up in what we call the relay room. The little magnet tells a valve to open up. That valve tells three other valves to open up, and it does it really quick.
The basic theory behind playing an organ of this type is that by using these switches and valves, you can add or subtract different organ sounds. Piece by piece, as York demonstrates, you can work from the softest sounds to the loudest.
If I add another sound. Now we add a thing called tremolo to that sound. Originally, the organ consoles, that's what we have here, the organ console had to be built at the organ because they had linkages from the keys to the pipes. And when Robert Hope Jones came up with this pneumatic electric idea, then the consoles could be set anywhere. They didn't have to be set at the organ. They could be set anywhere. This made it nicer for churches. You could put the console where you wanted it and have the pipes all over. You didn't have to build the console right in. Robert Home Jones' idea made it more practical to use them in theaters. They used little organs in pits, and they called them photo players. And you had a piano-like thing with two keyboards on it, and you had two boxes on both sides of it that had pipes in it. Didn't have as many pipes as we've got in here, but they used them to back up the movies, and they could be played by someone, or they could be played with a roll. Nowadays, we have computers on these. Someday this one will have the computer too. And we just put in the 3.5-inch floppy in there and tell the organ to play this song, and it will do it.
But until then, York does everything by hand and by ear. And he gets quite a workout playing the Wurlitzer.
I had never really paid attention to what was going on until they had done a recording here and then was describing what was going on over the radio, and I was listening to what they were describing. And the fellow said that he has his right hand on the upper manual, he has his left hand on the lower manual, and his feet are playing the pedals, and another foot is opening the volume, open and close, and said in between time he's changing stops. And I thought, my, that's busy.
The real heart of the organ is hidden away up in a back room behind stage left. The way up is a steep set of wooden stairs to a landing. On top of that landing is a door, behind which all of the guts of the organ live.
And then in here is the main operating parts.
It's a very small space, barely enough room for an adult to crawl around.
Starting with the quietest rank there in the front, which is the vox, the trumpet is here at the back, the loud one.
The loud drone is a leak in the seal that brings the air, which is the basic element needed in making sound with organ pipes, from the basement up to here. This is one of the many projects York and company are planning to work on. York is really in his element up here, explaining all the mechanics that go into generating the organ sounds.
When I push a tab that says 4-foot accompaniment, this goes up and connects all the pipes to the keys then. If I, pedal borden, the 16-foot, I push down on it, this goes up, connects the pedals to the low pipes along the back. This is the basic, this is the relay. Each one of these here, you can see I've got them labeled as C, 25C, 28D sharp. Each one of these is connected to one of the keys on the organ. There's a pedal one here, this is the lower keyboard, this is the upper keyboard. And all the stuff goes through this, through these, and then out to the pipes. First time I came down and started working with this, I had just started learning about theater, about pipe organ, theater organs. And I crawled back in here, and it was even crowded more because the chimes was in here. The chimes is in another room down there. I moved them out. And I'm thinking, you know, if I get stuck in here, they're not going to find me for days. I was a little claustrophobic about crawling around or anything. It doesn't bother me anymore.
Now, the restoration of this Wurlitzer organ is not officially part of the Virginia Theater's renovation project. It is separately funded, and all the repairs and continuing work on this Wurlitzer have been done by York himself and a handful of volunteers. The Virginia Theater's Wurlitzer is just one of several organs that York plays. He has traveled all around the area to perform. Some Wurlitzers he has played have had more manuals, some have had more pipes, but it seems that the one at Champaign's Virginia Theater is the one he's put his heart into. York knows that this type of music will never be as popular as it once was, but there are still many out there, like him, who can't live without the unique sounds of the Wurlitzer organ. For Sidetrack, I'm Jason Croft. You're listening to Sidetrack. Think of the fads of the 1950s. Think of hula hoops, Davy Crockett caps, fallout shelters. Well, you're not thinking big enough. The early to mid-50s was marked by a bigger fad, a pastime that hasn't entirely gone away. Back in July 2000, Jim Meadows talked to the man who started this fad.
Recently, I took brushes and paint and produced a picture. It was a bold, brightly colored scene of three race cars speeding down a racetrack. It was my first painting, but it didn't take long to complete. All I had to do was follow the numbers, and soon I had joined the legions of people around the world who are part of the paint-by-numbers experience.
It's quite simple. He merely fills in the colors as indicated by numbers found here and there on the canvas. Numbers put on by experts at the Palmer Paint Company of Detroit.
It helps to be of a certain age to understand the wide appeal once enjoyed by paint by numbers. This snippet from the TV show Industry on Parade dates back to the 1950s, when the paint by numbers fad was at its height. Sales of the pre-sketched paintings reached an estimated $80 million in 1955. I learned that nugget of information from the man who could be called the inventor of paint by numbers.
I think I'm here to talk about paint by numbers. And as you may or may not know, I not only wrote a book called Whatever Happened to Paint by Numbers, but I'm also the fellow that created the original concept for paint by numbers way back in the 1950s.
That's artist and advertising man Dan Robbins of the Chicago suburb of Oak Brook, opening his slide presentation before a small gathering recently at the Douglas County Museum in Tuscola. Robbins signed on with the Palmer Paint Company in 1949 to develop children's paint sets. They were essentially coloring sets, and Robbins had the idea of extending the product line and developing a coloring set for adults.
I had remembered a reading about Leonardo da Vinci and how he used to hand out numbered assignments to all of his students and apprentices. His idea was to give them numbered outlines and so they could start to block in basic colors that he could then come along and finish up. And I thought to myself, gee, that's a pretty good idea.
The first paint-by-numbers prototype was a sort of cubist still life designed by Robbins to show to his boss, Palmer Paint Company President Max Klein. As Robbins tells it, Klein hated the painting but loved the concept and became the original paint-by-numbers entrepreneur, selling the original paint-by-numbers brand, Craftmaster.
After the paints, in go brushes, canvases, and directions for use. By sensing a real public demand and knowing how to fill it, this firm, under strong competition in the paint-it-yourself field, has advanced in 4 years from zero to the production of 75,000 sets a day.
It was Dan Robbins who designed the Craftmaster paint-by-numbers format, from the paint and gelatin capsules inserted into artists' palettes to the picture designs lightly outlined and numbered on pieces of canvas similar to window shade fabric. He also worked on marketing and promotion, including the copy written on the boxes to sell the half-completed pictures inside.
And I must tell you, the more we wrote, the funnier it sounded, and the funnier it sounded, the more we enjoyed writing it. The Bullfighter. Stand aside, you weaklings, for here the red on your brush turns magically into flowing blood as climax of Matador versus Bull draws near. As your numbered colors bring life and drama to your canvas, the excitement of the moment is without parallel, for here is tension, lust, and fury. Boy, we had a good time.
When the picture accompanying that Bullfighter copy showed up in Robin's slide presentation, I took notice. I recognized the painting of a matador, his billowing red cape capturing the attention of a black bull charging on the sand-colored earth of the bull ring. I had only spent my childhood in a bedroom with that picture on the wall. My father painted that painting. But, of course, he was painting a paint-by-numbers picture. The actual creator was Dan Robbins, who says he personally designed the first 75 to 100 paint-by-numbers paintings. After that, Robbins started hiring other artists for the newly invented task of designing paint-by-numbers paintings.
There was no such thing as paint-by-numbers. We couldn't advertise for a paint-by-number artist, but we advertised for an artist who could do life portraits, because those are the most challenging. And we figured that anybody who could do life portraits would have a better sense overall of what it took to create paint-by-numbers. This is a very good example. Adam Grant did this. He was a very, very fine painter.
The late Adam Grant was the first artist Robbins hired for Craftmaster paint-by-numbers. A Grant-designed picture was part of a wall filled with paint-by-number paintings that Dan Robbins and I inspected at the Douglas County Museum. Craftmaster had many competitors during paint-by-numbers heyday, and Robbins knew which were which.
I can tell very much, looking at some of these subjects, that they're not Craftmaster. And again, I'm not demeaning any of these, because they have paint-by-numbers has their own particular style. But I could tell you in a minute, looking at all these subjects, which ones are Craftmasters and which ones are competitors.
The paint-by-numbers format presents particular challenges. In their own oil paintings, a Dan Robbins or an Adam Grant could mix and blend colors, suggesting a wide range of texture and shadow. But in the mass-produced paint-by-numbers kits, each color lies separately on the canvas, giving the effect of a silk-screened poster. It's not easy to present subtle detail with this technique, especially when the design must be kept simple enough to be completed by amateurs. Robbins points out the difference in two paint-by-number religious paintings, neither of them by Craftmaster. One shows Jesus as the Good Shepherd cradling a lamb, but Robbins prefers the other, depicting Jesus at the Last Supper.
When you look at what's called a red robe here, and when you look at what's called a red robe here, you see the difference? They just don't have the palette of colors.
And what we're saying is that what you feel is the Last Supper painting,
right?
The artist is using, I'd say, about three or four shades
He's
of red.
He's got at least one, two, three, four, yes, four or five shades to give the red color to the robe.
But here, in the Good Shepherd painting here,
there's only two colors, red and some dark brown color, which doesn't come off.
The Last Supper may be the single most popular subject in paint-by-number history. Robin says religious themes, landscapes, and animals were dependable sellers. During paint-by-number's heyday, Craftmaster also produced pictures of celebrities and custom pictures. You sent in a family photo through a participating store, and Craftmaster would send back a special paint-by-numbers version. Craftmaster even offered paint-by-numbers paintings of tastefully posed female nudes.
But in our literature and in our promotion, we never showed those pictures so that anybody looking at the particular literature or the particular set could only see a blank space, which described the fact that it was a nude, but Better Sense of Valor told us not to reproduce that because we didn't want to offend anybody.
How did they sell?
They sold very, very well.
It's the reduction in physical exertion required of us these days, whether we work in home or factory, that has left us with a greatly increased capacity for hobbies of all kinds.
As Industry on Parade suggested, paint-by-numbers was just a hobby. But some cultural critics of the 1950s detected the inference that the people who filled in the numbered spaces on paint-by-numbers kits had done something like actually painting their own painting. These critics railed against paintitis,
and fillers inners of numbered pictures. Defenders said that working through a paint-by-numbers painting could encourage painters to try some real painting of their own. The late Elmer Olson appears to have fit that argument. His paint-by-number painting of Jesus was brought to Dan Robbins' presentation for signing by Olson's granddaughter, Cindy Pringle of Pisotum.
This one I'd say he did probably in the late 1950s.
Did he do a lot of paint-by-number?
He did a fair bit. He painted his own paintings too, but I think he got really started with the paint-by-numbers, what got him interested in painting.
So he went from doing this to doing his own painting?
Yes, and he liked large paintings, a lot of patriotic type of paintings and religious paintings also.
By the time Elmer Olson painted his paint-by-numbers Jesus, the paint-by-numbers fad had already peaked. But the product never went away. Today, a few companies in the U.S. and Europe still offer paint-by-number products. And the original Craftmaster brand continues as Craft House of Toledo, Ohio. Dan Robbins, who left the paint-by-numbers business in the 1970s, says he's on good terms with Craft House, but says the product isn't what it used to be.
I don't think that the artists that are working on paint-by-numbers today are as focused as we were when it was really hot. That's the first thing. The second thing I'm finding out is that a lot of the paint-by-numbers subjects are being created via computer. And in my opinion, they lack the quality of an original piece of art.
Critics didn't think words like original and art applied to paint-by-numbers pictures, but Dan Robbins isn't upset by the critics. In his view, paint-by-numbers gave millions of people, if not art, at least the experience of art.
They appealed to most people's sense of creativity. Also, the fact that it was numbered also guaranteed almost instant success, so that anybody who would pick up a brush and dab paint into numbered spaces with numbered colors was literally guaranteed of success, and I think that was one of the appeals.
By the way, it's not as easy as it looks. I had a lot of trouble staying within the lines with my Craft House paint-by-numbers race cars. I was using a beginner's kit. By contrast, my father's Craftmaster Bullfight paint-by-numbers canvases from the 1950s show a superior technique. My father says he found the paint-by-numbers experience very restful. For Sidetrack, I'm Jim Meadows.
Well, that does it for this special 5th anniversary edition of Sidetrack. This episode, as well as every episode we've done, is available in real audio on our website. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. A big thank you goes out to everyone who has helped out the program, from doing features to helping record live performances. We couldn't have gotten this far without you. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Join us again in June for another edition of Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.